This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson in Washington. Mentally ill people are far more likely to be crime victims than perpetrators. Federal statistics show as little as 3% of violent acts can be connected to mental illness. But for those who do commit violent acts, the way we deal with them changed 20 years ago on a New York subway platform. Kendra Webdale was waiting for the N train at 23rd Street. Then, a man in the throes of a psychotic episode pushed her off the platform.
Defense attorney Harvey Fishbein told jurors that Andrew Goldstein was, quote, temporarily insane and not responsible for his actions the day he killed Kendra Webdale. In a 23-minute videotaped confession, Goldstein admitted that he had asked Webdale for the time before shoving the 32-year-old off a subway platform inside the 23rd Street station last January. Prosecutors argue Goldstein calculated the crime and is using his mental illness as, quote, a shield.
That crime sparked Kendra's Law. It put in place something called assisted outpatient treatment, a court order to force treatment and medication on a severely mentally ill person. The law applies to people with a history of violence and of resisting treatment. Kendra Webdale's sister Kim Webdale spoke at the law's signing nearly 20 years ago.
Kendra's Law is a symbol of renewed hope for all people affected by mental illness. It represents hope that the untreated mentally ill who suffer needlessly will be able to live fuller, more productive lives within their communities. It represents hope that New York's streets and neighborhoods and subways will be safer places for all people. And most of all, Kendra's Law represents hope that another family will never have to experience the heartache of losing a cherished member of their family.
Today, 46 states have some version of Kendra's Law. What is it? How does it work? Who does it help? And what should its future look like? Joining us from NPR in New York is Bill Keller, the editor-in-chief of The Marshall Project, a nonprofit journalism group that covers criminal justice. Bill, welcome to 1A.
Thank you.
Also with us is Eric Smith. He's a graduate student based in San Antonio, working on his master's in clinical mental health testing. He has firsthand experience receiving assisted outpatient treatment. Eric, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Before I get to your story, Eric, I should note that we do want your questions and your stories about dealing with Kendra's Law or your questions about the way that we deal with violently mentally ill people in America today. So email us, 1A@WAMU.org, comment on our Facebook page or tweet us at 1A. We also have some helplines to share with you a little bit later on if this issue hits particularly close to home for you or your family. Stand by for that. But Eric, let me start with you. At one time, you did actually meet the requirements of Kendra's Law. We'll get into those in a moment, but let's begin at the beginning. When did you and your parents begin to suspect that you were having some kind of mental health problem?
Thank you for that question. First, I'd really like to say that I am of the mindset that it is never too early to have a conversation about mental health, but there are times when it is too late to do so, whether the result is suicide or being murdered by a person who is mentally unwell, as was the case with Kendra Webdale. To your question, I was diagnosed as being bipolar for the first time when I was in my early to mid-teenage years. And prior to that, I assumed the way I felt was the way other people felt, because prior to my diagnosis, I had no way of knowing the way I felt was out of the norm in any way. That led up to my first hospitalization much later in towards the end of 2008, and I was ultimately hospitalized three different times, and since 2012 have not been hospitalized since. And there's a lot that happens in the middle of all of those timeline points, but that sort of summarizes it.
Now, how did all of this come to a head where you kind of came into conflict or came into contact with the law?
That's an excellent question. So I actually do not have a history of violence, and I heard in the opening setting that AOT is really set up for individuals who have a history of violence and a history of being, you know, mentally unstable in some ways. And for me, I actually did not have a history of violence towards other people. But the fact that I was not a participant in reality, that in and of itself was a danger to me. And that's really what got me in, as opposed to being a violent offender with a history of such.
Can you clarify that a little bit? What do you mean by not being a participant in reality? How did that manifest itself?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I'm actually just using that statement to highlight the fact that while physically my body was here in reality, mentally I was someplace else. It was not my thoughts at the point that led me into the hospitalization were not grounded in reality, and it took a nonviolent altercation with police, to which I was arrested for trespassing, that got me in jail. And the reason that I bring that up is because I was in jail for a month, and I needed medication, needed it. And as I'm sure you're aware, a jail is not a pharmacy and is really meant to deal with people who are, you know, violating the law. And when I got there, they had none of the medications that I was prescribed. And so for a month, I was essentially untreated medication-wise. And right as I was about to be released, and I am not exaggerating when I say it was right about as I was about to be released from jail after my month's stay, a bed in the state hospital opened up, and I was very lucky to have been transferred there. And lucky because had I not been in San Antonio, which is a place that has the AOT in place, I would have just been released. And who knows what would have happened, but I was not in a good place at that time. Bill, so I am very thankful.
Bill Keller, let me bring you in. Give us a little bit, a clearer picture on what exactly Kendra's Law is. Eric is talking about AOT. His situation is quite different from the situation that involved Kendra Webdale. But give us a sense of this law, what it is and what it involves.
Well, you said at the outset there are all but four states, actually it's now all but three because Tennessee passed one, that have these laws, but they differ dramatically in both in what the law says and how it's carried out. The biggest difference between New York and the others, I've been told, is that in most of the states, it's an option that's presented to the county mental health officials that they can offer a Kendra's Law solution. In New York, it's mandatory. The county has to make available a Kendra's Law discipline, which basically consists of going before a judge with a psychiatrist and getting court approval of a treatment regime that usually includes medication but includes other things as well. And then essentially because you've been deemed potentially dangerous to yourself or others, or you've actually demonstrated violence, you go to the head of the line for a lot of the services that are, while in woefully short supply, are offered to the mentally ill. Housing, for example, counseling, you get assigned either a person or a team of people who monitor your progress and make sure that you're staying on your meds. I think 16,000 New Yorkers have been through this process, and most of them, after a year or two, essentially graduate from it into regular citizenship.
Mm-hmm. Do the requirements for the Kendra's Laws programs in different parts of the country kind of resemble what the requirements are in New York in terms of a history of violence and refusing treatment, or does it really vary from state to state?
I haven't read all of the 40-some laws out there, but I think what they have in common is that it takes place under a court order, which I think Eric will agree is something that most people in the program find extremely important. It makes everybody take it more seriously.
Mm-hmm.
What a lot of states do not do is provide the sort of therapeutic infrastructure and funding that New York has been better at.
We are speaking to Bill Keller, the editor-in-chief at the Marshall Project, and Eric Smith, a graduate student in San Antonio, Texas. We welcome your questions and thoughts as well, 1A@WAMU.org. A member of the 1A Text Club contacted us and writes, I haven't had any experience with this law, but I do suffer from mental illness, and I know that things in this country have to change. Perceptions, treatments, laws. It's not easy to live with a mental illness. And it's even harder when treatments are hard to find and are usually wrong because of misdiagnosis or just lack of understanding or training. Eric Smith, could you respond to that in terms of what you encountered overall in terms of being treated for bipolar disorder versus being in AOT? Was it just an extension of the same set of societal problems with treating mental illness, or was your AOT situation kind of unique?
I actually believe that everybody's AOT situation is unique. The overlapping sort of information that ties the folks in AOT together is diagnosis. So you may find various people who are on the outpatient side of things bipolar, you know, schizoaffective, schizophrenic. But that doesn't mean that, you know, obviously they're the same person. They have a different set of experiences. They may have differing degrees on a spectrum of that diagnosis. And so I would say that I can't speak to other people's experience who are bipolar like myself. What I can speak to is the fact that AOT and what it looks like, where, you know, there's a judge, a psychiatrist, social worker, attorney, and the rest of the treatment team who gather in an informal setting to assess me and other individuals who are part of AOT. It starts out about once a week, and then if things are going well and the individual is taking their meds, presenting as well enough to remain in AOT without needing further hospitalization on the inpatient side of things, the informal hearings become less frequent, perhaps every couple of weeks, then once a month. And ultimately, this is a path that's intended to lead an individual to graduate out of AOT, regardless of what their experience had been up to that point,
and
become reintegrated back into society as an individual who takes medication as prescribed without a court order saying that needs to be done.
Yeah, I do want to ask you more about that, Eric, when we continue. Pause for one moment, if you would, please. And before we break, I just wanted to share one of those hotline numbers for you, particularly if you or someone you know is struggling with thoughts of suicide. This is the number to the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline. It's free, confidential, open 24/7. The number is 800-273-8255. That's 800-273-TALK. That's the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline. We're speaking to Eric Smith and Bill Keller. We'll continue our conversation and get to more of your questions and stories in just a moment. I'm Joshua Johnson, and you're listening to 1A from WAMU and NPR. This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson. We're talking about how America treats the severely mentally ill, particularly those who have had violent episodes or fallen through the cracks of the system. We're speaking to Eric Smith, the graduate student in San Antonio, who's had firsthand experience with assisted outpatient treatment, or AOT, and Bill Keller, the editor-in-chief at The Marshall Project. We welcome more of your questions and stories. Comment on our Facebook page, tweet us at 1A, or email 1A@wamu.org. We have a few more guests we'd like to get to, and you've sent us some really remarkable stories about your experiences, not only with Kendra's Law, but just with the way we deal with mental health treatment in general. Aaron writes, I think we still suffer from way too many people believing that mental health problems are just a willpower problem, and that if you just think positive thoughts, your depression will go away. Having had a mother who had clinical depression, I know that there is a huge difference between it and having a bad day. Very true, Aaron. And I know that there may be some of you listening who have interest in mental health services but don't quite know where to start. There's a federal helpline. This is the second of the numbers we wanted to share. Free 24/7 confidential hotline that can refer you to services where you live, including those that accept Medicare, Medicaid, or have sliding pay scales. Here is that number, 800-662-4357. That's the number for the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration's hotline, 800-662-4357. Bill Keller, let me come back to you for a minute. Talk about what you have found that mentally ill inmates that you have reported on experience when they're receiving treatment under Kendra's Law, particularly when it begins while they're still incarcerated. What is that like?
Well, I'm not sure I can describe it without having gone through it. I'm just a reporter, not a doctor or a lawyer. But I know because we focused on one particular victim of severe schizophrenia, namely Andrew Goldstein, who was the one who pushed Kendra onto the train tracks. I did do some looking into what he can expect when he's released. He's actually been released. He was released into a psychiatric hospital, where he'll be evaluated by a clinical team, and they will decide what next for him. One option certainly is Kendra's Law. I know a number of people, including Kendra Webdale's mother, believe that he's a natural candidate for that particular regimen. But there are other options, too. There are less There are regimes that have less oversight. And then there's, of course, the ultimate threat of being confined in a mental hospital, which most states, I think, I'll defer to a lawyer on this one, but I think most states allow commitment of people who represent an imminent threat to themselves or others.
Eric Smith, you touched on this a bit, but go a little deeper, if you wouldn't mind, about what your AOT was like when you were in a treatment program. Where were you put? How long were you inside a facility versus kind of out in the world on your own recognizance? What was that like?
Sure. So I was actually in and out of the hospital on the inpatient side of things, and then thereafter AOT a few different times. And on paper, that could look like a failure of sorts to some folks. But the rest of the story, what I've accomplished since my last AOT order in 2012, that does speak to the success of what AOT can do for a person who's lucky enough to have AOT where they live. And for me, what that looked like is first to acknowledge that it's not a cookie cutter. It's not, you know, someone gets a diagnosis, then the next step is this many days of an informal hearing. It really is, it's decided by people who have the information to make a proper decision about individuals such as myself. It's the judge, the psychiatrist, social worker, attorney, and so on. And those informal hearings, they lasted, you know, anywhere from about, you know, I'd say 5 or 10 minutes to perhaps even, you know, 15 or 20 minutes. And that doesn't sound like a long time, but when you've got a room full of professionals who are seasoned and understanding the needs of individuals who will find themselves in an AOT program, they are acting as gatekeepers between the outpatient side of things and being reintegrated into society. And I don't know about you, but I think it's a great idea to have a bunch of eyeballs from professionals determining where an individual is at in their recovery and whether or not it's appropriate to continue with AOT, to send them back on the inpatient side of things, or to then decide, hey, you know, thank you for being an AOT. You've done a great job. You've graduated from this, and back into society you go.
Did you ever push back against any of the plan? Did you ever refuse to take your medication, for example?
That might be the question that I get most often when I talk to people about this, and that's a great question. So on the inpatient side of things, I do and did have the right, as others do, to refuse medicines as prescribed, but doing that resulted in those medicines being administered usually by injection. So the reason I'm bringing this up is because if you find an individual who's just on a daily basis on the inpatient side of things saying, I'm not going to take my meds, and they're getting injections, they are not a good candidate for AOT, is my understanding. But the individuals who are taking their meds as prescribed and realizing, hey, this beats the alternative of, for lack of a better term, just being insane on a daily basis, those are the individuals who are taking their meds regularly. They are great candidates for AOT, and thereby the informal hearings that decide ultimately the next step is they're looking at those individuals who have decided it's a good idea to take their meds.
Sounds like that's kind of the power of Kendra's Law, being able to compel someone through the force of the judicial system to stay on their assisted outpatient treatment program. Before we let you go, Eric, I'm wondering, where are you now? What are you up to? How is life for you these days?
Thank you for asking. Life looks a lot different. In 2012, when I was released for the last time in AOT, I had dreams of going to community college. And then, you know, I said, let's take a bigger step. I got into a university, graduated in the top 10% of my class, and I'm now a graduate student pursuing a Master of Science in Clinical Mental Health Counseling. And as a final note, I'd also like to mention that the Treatment Advocacy Center is working to further AOT across the country, and that communities interested in AOT should feel free to contact them to learn more about it. And while not everywhere, AOT does exist in many places, in many different states, and the Treatment Advocacy Center is largely to thank for that. And it's not just big cities that can use AOT. It's my understanding that some federal grants actually went to smaller places and communities, like those that can be found in Ohio, and they are seeing much success with it. So in short, AOT is not a program that can only help people if they're near a downtown or in a big city. It's really there for everybody to help everybody.
Eric Smith, a graduate student living in San Antonio, working on his master's in clinical mental health testing. Eric, it takes a lot of guts to share a story like the one that you shared, and we really appreciate you doing it. Thanks very much for talking to us.
Thank you.
Let's continue our conversation. We'll keep Bill Keller and add a few more voices to the discussion. Joining us from Duke University is psychiatry professor Marvin Swartz. He's been studying the effectiveness of services for severely mentally ill people for more than two decades. Dr. Swartz, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
And also at NPR in New York, Beth Haroulis is a senior staff attorney at the New York Civil Liberties Union. She has challenged parts of Kendra's law numerous times in court. Beth, glad to have you with us.
Hi, thanks.
Dr. Swartz, let me start with you. What is it about Kendra's law that interested you in terms of a focus of research? Does it stand out in terms of the way that mental health is dealt with nationwide?
So as a young psychiatrist, I was working on a inpatient unit, acute unit, and working in a prison, and encountered these patients who we called revolving door patients in those times, who were people who would respond to treatment on an inpatient setting or in prison when given medication, but would go out and be non-adherent to treatment and come back. And it was an enormously frustrating cycle for everyone, for the patients, for the families, for the clinicians. And so I got interested in a law that North Carolina had on the books, which was a forerunner of what's now called AOT, called involuntary outpatient commitment. And I wondered if we could conduct an experiment to see if it's effective. And so we went about designing a randomized controlled trial of involuntary outpatient commitment in North Carolina to ascertain whether it could be effective in helping people who were non-adherent with treatment and had frequent hospitalizations.
Beth, you argued against the law when it came up in New York. What was your argument against Kendra's law?
Well, we had a few arguments largely relating to the degree of evidence that needed to be presented to courts in connection with Kendra's order recipients who were deemed noncompliant once the order was entered. We had originally challenged the legislation when it was being introduced because it did permit involuntary administration of medication outside a hospital setting. And after a lot of discussion with the legislature, they realized that would make the law fundamentally unconstitutional. So what they did do was to impose a mandatory pickup order that if a person is alleged to be noncompliant, there is a mental hygiene arrest. Basically, the police come to pick the person up and transport them to a psychiatric setting where they will be evaluated. The experiences in New York with that particular pickup order, which the Court of Appeals said was fine, is that most people are not deemed in need of hospitalization. So there's a lot of wasted effort put into transporting. So you have police resources, you have clinical resources, mm-hmm. and of course you have the impact on the person who is in a compulsive treatment regimen where you wonder about the degree to which there's a therapeutic alliance where the person is actually highly committed to succeeding in the program. So we raised all of those issues. The Court of Appeals, you know, did not buy it. And so we've had Kendra's law in effect since 1999. It has not been made permanent in New York State. There continues to be pretty robust reporting, study. What has been determined, I think, is that a person with a Kendra's order gets bumped to the top of the line. And I think, as Bill Keller had mentioned, there are very, very few resources out there in the community, and a person with a Kendra's order is bumped to the top of the line.
Yeah, and to that point about resources, particularly as it relates to the criminal justice system, we got a comment from Shirley II, who writes, meaning no disrespect to Kendra, in some ways her killer was also a victim of the system. Time and again, he went to various mental health facilities for help, only to be given platitudes and sent home. Ironically, it was finally in prison that he got the help he needed. That's not what our criminal justice system was created to do. But these days, it seems like we should just hang a sign that says hospital on many of our prisons, given how many mentally ill people are incarcerated there. I'm Joshua Johnson, and you're listening to 1A. We also heard from a listener through our 1A text club and wrote, speaking from experience, if there is a lack of adequate funding for mental health services and a shortage of professionals, the laws have little use except maybe to put people in prison. Beth, could you react to that?
Well, you know, I mean, certainly the experience in New York State, particularly Rikers, is that Rikers is the largest mental health facility in the state. What we're seeing is an effort to reduce the numbers of people who are in the criminal justice system because of a mental health issue with diversion at the front end. Kendra's Law actually is playing a part in connection with diverting people from prison settings. Because remember, Kendra's Law, in New York State at least, applies to individuals who have had an act of violence or a threat of violence within a 48-month period, or a person who has had an involuntary hospitalization twice within 36 months. So you have a very divergent pool of people who could be subjected to an order. For people who might have a brush with the criminal justice system, there is another aspect that's come into play in New York after Kendra's Law was passed called assertive community treatment. And folks in that oftentimes have a Kendra's order, and within the Kendra's system, they're pumped up even higher in terms of priority services so that you're diverting people from a penal institution. Within the penal institutions, I know there's been much effort made to identify individuals who have mental health issues, who may have a developmental disability, who may have substance issues, in order to figure out exactly what you do, because resources that are going into housing somebody without providing treatment are just wasted when those resources could be put into community-based services.
Bill Keller, do we know how many inmates are severely mentally ill in New York? Is there a sense of the proportion of those who either are bound by a Kendra's Law court order or could be, compared to the general prison population, to this point about prisons kind of becoming de facto mental health facilities?
I know a national number. It's a very round number, but based on some national surveys, it's around 400,000 severely mentally ill, not just people. I think some people have said that more than half of the prison population nationally has some kind of disorder. But the severe cases are about 400,000 nationally, which is double the number that were in prison at the time that Kendra Webdale died.
Dylan emailed, "The threat of Kendra's Law has paralyzed my ability to effectively communicate about my depression for years, not because of murderous impulses, but rather suicidal ones. Kendra's Law is reactionary and written to benefit those who have never experienced true mental illness, to separate out the bad apples. It comes from a place of fear rather than understanding." I wonder if you might react to that one also, Bill, also just in terms of the cultural perception around Kendra's Law in New York. Let me throw one more comment in there as well to that point. Brian emailed, "How is it that a single rare act of violence by someone not in their right mind changes the law nationwide, while violent acts by those in their right minds happen daily with no uproar? Rampant gun violence does not change laws. Rampant financial violence does not change laws. Rampant substance abuse kills daily on our highways, but laws do not change. Why did this incident spark such a dramatic change?" I know we have to pause in a moment, but Bill, what about that, the cultural place that Kendra's Law holds?
Well, it's certainly true that it was a turning point. It was a very high-profile case. One of my then-colleagues, Michael Weinrup of the New York Times, wrote a piece in the Times Magazine. He got access to the psychiatric file of the man who killed Kendra, and it reflected a long history of neglect and a system that was just overstretched and unsympathetic. And so the combination of the shame and then just the public horror at that act got legislators motivated to pass the law. I think there's some truth in the fact that it was legislated out of fear. I mean, that's the same reason a lot of people tend to stand back from the subway tracks these days when they're waiting for a train.
Yeah, yeah. George Grace O'Malley writes, "I worked in community mental health for almost four decades. My state, Missouri, has outpatient commitment laws, but it is of very minimal usefulness. You can't call the police every time someone refuses medication. What we need are more resources to do outreach to people who are untreated or undiagnosed, and more of an ability to do intensive follow-up, building relationships that encourage people to participate in treatment." Now, we've said the vast majority of people with mental illness are not violent. We are talking about a small percentage change overall and hearing about how we keep them safe and keep the public safe, too. We've heard from a lawyer that has fought Kendra's law. In a moment, we'll hear from a lawmaker in New York who's fighting to extend the law permanently. Stay close. We, like the rest of the country, are monitoring the latest updates on the path of Hurricane Florence. We're expecting an update on its track from the National Hurricane Center shortly. Your NPR station will be one of your best places for quick, accurate information. Anyone who's been through one knows that a battery-powered radio can feel like a lifeline when the power goes out. We also know that a large part of 1A's family is based in the Carolinas, covering this storm as their own homes and families are in Florence's path. We're thinking of you and your friends. Please do stay safe as you cover the storm and keep your listeners safe. If you are in the path of Florence and want to tell us how you're preparing for what's to come or what you're dealing with ahead of the storm or in its aftermath, we'd always love to hear from you. Leave us a voicemail, 855-236-1A, 1A. That's 855-236-1212. You can contact us through our app, 1A Vox Pop. Always email us, 1A@WAMU.org. If you have pictures to share of what you've encountered, please do not put yourself in danger to take pictures of the aftermath. We are not worth it. Stay safe and give us a call by voicemail, 855-236-1A1A. We'll do our best to get you the information you need here on your NPR member station and online at npr.org. Back now to our conversation with Bill Keller, Dr. Marvin Swartz, and Beth Haroulis. Let me share a few more of your stories before we bring in one more guest. Jules tweeted, I worked in mental health for a long time, and I know AOT, assisted outpatient treatment, is important in certain circumstances, but the burden of proof required to institute forced medication is simply not high enough. Forced medication is a serious infringement on Fourth Amendment protections, and I think the state should have to show much more potential risk before permitting forced medication. Beth Haroulis, we've talked to you a bit about your perspective on this, but Dr. Swartz, I wonder what you think about this idea of mandated treatment from the state. Do we know that these kinds of regimens, AOT and Kendra's Law, that they are effective?
We have found in the studies I referred to earlier, both in North Carolina and New York, that these laws, when well implemented and resourced, can help. And we found that it reduced rates of rehospitalization, reduced rates of violence, reduced stress, helped people take their medication, and saved, for example, in the state of New York, saved a considerable amount of money for the mental health system, about 50%. So I think it's sort of a red herring, the issue of forced medication. None of the AOT laws directly permit forced medication. What they do is allow court oversight and a demand for accountability of the mental health system in an effort to make it more effective.
Now, Beth Haroulis, I wonder about that. I mean, if the medications work, if they reduce the crime rates, if they help to prevent violent offenders from reoffending, you know, where is the line in terms of how much we can curtail civil liberties for those who've committed crimes for the sake of keeping the rest of us safe?
Well, I mean, it's a balancing test, obviously. And, you know, again, I don't know that there's any evidence that demonstrates that, you know, putting a person on medication will, in fact, reduce any sort of, you know, crime rate. Remember, in New York State, with Kendra's Law, most folks are nonviolent individuals with mental health issues who have not previously been connected to services. What a Kendra's order does is give that person a case manager who coordinates services. There is a medication plan. There's oftentimes mandatory drug and urine testing. Oftentimes you get priority for supportive housing. You get mandated into certain counseling sessions. These are services that just don't exist for most of the population. And so you can identify a cadre of people, and the people that are now getting the assertive community treatment, in fact, are the ones who tend to present a possible risk of violence or risk of some sort of crime or a connection to the criminal justice system. So those folks are getting a lot of services, a lot of attention, and services that, you know, they had never been connected to. They had not previously been identified as a person with a mental health issue, or they had and they just weren't given access to services. So when you look at whether it's necessary to have a court order in order to obtain access to services that protect you and protect the community, you have to wonder what the politicians think when they initiate legislation that mandates a certain percentage of the population into a connection to services and fails to understand that you need to make those services more broadly available within the community.
Well, speaking of lawmakers, we should bring in one more voice to talk about that very thing. Joining us now is New York State Senator Catherine Young, a Republican lawmaker representing a district that includes Jamestown and Chautauqua, New York. She's been the primary sponsor of Kendra's law since 2005. Senator Young, welcome to 1A.
Thank you so much. It's great to be with you.
Can we go back to a previous question that was asked in terms of why Kendra's law had such an impact and made such a change? You were in the New York State Assembly, as I understand it, when the first version of Kendra's law was being drafted. What was the atmosphere like then? Why did Kendra's law have such an impact?
Well, first of all, Kendra Webdale grew up in my Senate district, and her parents, many of her family members still live there. And you have to salute the family because they realized right away that there was a significant deficit in the system, in the mental health system in New York State. And so they advocated with the lawmakers, with the governor at the time. We were able to get something in place. And, you know, Andrew Goldstein, who murdered Kendra, had been failed by the system. He had acted out repeatedly, been violent, and after he pushed Kendra in front of a 400-ton subway train, he said, "I'm psychotic, take me to the hospital." And so
he said
yes, he actually said that.
Okay.
And so he knew on one level that he was dangerous, but there was nothing that he personally could do about it because he was so sick. So he, you know, I think his words are powerful now. He recently said that he believes that Kendra's law is a very good idea to help people. And that's what we see. Oftentimes when people have serious mental illness, it's very difficult for them to seek treatment. It's very difficult for them to make good decisions. And so this is a way, a very effective way, to get people into the treatment that they need. And, you know, you look at New York State, for example, and in the city, in New York City, Rikers Island is one of the most notorious prison systems, and it has more than 4,000 inmates with seriously mentally ill in the population. Mm-hmm. And so even by Mayor de Blasio standards, he issued a report and said Rikers Island is by far the largest psychiatric facility in New York State. I think that's a real tragedy, and we see that story repeated across the state in jails after jails after jails, county jails, where they're not equipped to deal with people with mental illness. And when you look at the studies that have been done, and you know, I want to thank Dr. Schwartz for his input, but when you look at the studies that have been done, it is undeniable that the participants, by far, are benefiting from assisted outpatient treatment. And I want to commend Eric Smith because I believe he is a shining example of what happens when people get into AOT. And as Dr. Schwartz pointed out, it reduces suicides, it reduces violence, it reduces incarcerations and recidivism, it reduces hospitalizations, it reduces drug and alcohol use. And, you know, across this country, we have an exploding problem with heroin, for example, and oftentimes people with untreated mental illness try to treat themselves by self-medicating with drugs or alcohol.
True, and I'm sorry to cut you short. I did want to get back to Dr. Schwartz to the point that you were making. Dr. Schwartz, I wonder if there's anything we've learned or anything you've learned through your research about what forms of Kendra's Law are most effective, least effective? Is it a matter of the duration of the treatment? Is it a matter of the kind of treatment that's offered? Is it just a matter of funding it properly so that there's a bed for everyone who needs it and a counselor for everyone who needs it? Like, what do we know are the best practices, for lack of a better term, for Kendra's Law?
So as it was implemented in New York, what happened was it infused new funding for services. It prioritized who should go to the front of the queue, as we said earlier. But very importantly, it added this layer of accountability over the system, in that part of Kendra's Law is that there's an AOT team in each county that follows up and makes sure that the patient is getting the services mandated in the AOT order, makes sure they're getting them, and looks at the need for any adjustments in the treatment plan if needed. Basically, the pickup orders are not really, in our view, how AOT works. How it works, we really think, is that it requires that service providers step up and really pay attention to the population who's under AOT, that families recognize that the court is concerned about this individual, and the patient gets the message that, you know, people are concerned about their condition and they need to try harder to be compliant with the treatment plan. So it's an effort to nudge the system, give it the system more fuel in terms of funding, but make it more accountable for priority populations. The punitive aspects of it are really, I think, relatively minor. Just one other point that I think that's important is when we've asked people with serious mental illness, is this a fair trade-off? Would you trade off the voluntariness of your participation in treatment if you got these benefits? We found overwhelmingly that people with serious mental illness said, yeah, that seems like a fair trade-off. And life is full of trade-offs. You know, it's a relative to what question. If the default option is living under a bridge, being victimized, and staying psychotic.
Right.
What we've heard from seriously mentally ill people is that they would take the trade-off of being compelled to participate in treatment to get these benefits.
I'm Joshua Johnson. You're listening to 1A. Beth, I'd love you to jump in, particularly on this nature, this issue of having the option of Kendra's Law as an alternative to a worse fate. Sharon emailed, "My daughter was diagnosed as bipolar at 13 during her third stay at a mental hospital. I worked hard to be sure she had help through high school, but once she turned 18, things got much more difficult. She was on a list for therapy, but was told she would not get help for at least a year. No therapy, no meds, no help. She was not violent, but she was severely ill. The system ignored her. I never even heard about Kendra's Law." Beth, I imagine there are people who would rather at least have the option, even if it's involuntary treatment, forced treatment, that could be better than the alternative. What would you say to them?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, you know, look, at the end of the day, what we're looking at is Kendra's Law as a solution to a systemic failure. You have lots of people in New York State who never received the benefit of deinstitutionalization dollars, right? Closing the institutions garnered lots of money for the state. Those funds never got put into community-based services. So would we sit here and say, you know, fair trade-off? Yes, these are people who need services, who never have had access to services, who suddenly have a case manager, who are, in fact, invited to participate in the formulation of a treatment plan. It may not be meaningful at the beginning. We question at the end of the day, you know, that whole concept of therapeutic alliance. But for people who have never had services, who have never had coordination of services, access to housing, yes. Do you want people discharged to a homeless shelter from a psychiatric setting? No. Do you want people discharged to the street? No. But why New York State has not made Kendra's Law permanent is because of the concerns about the fact that you're cherry-picking the population, leaving a lot of people unserved. And in New York State, there's a highly gendered and racial component to the imposition of a Kendra's order. You see, in terms of the demographics, that the larger percent of people under a Kendra's order are men of color, 21 to 45. And, you know, when the reporting was done with respect to Kendra's Law, you know, there was an indication that really why there was a racial gendered aspect was out of the scope of the reporting. But the indication was, and the speculation was, that these people in this population were not served.
Beth, I hate to cut you short. I know we're running low on time. I'm really sorry to cut you short, but I do want to get back to the state senator, Catherine Young. To that point, you want to make Kendra's law permanent. I know we're low on time, but give me a sense of what you would like to see in the permanent version of Kendra's law if it passed. Do you want it to go into state law instead of having to be renewed every few years? Do you want it to go into state law exactly as it exists now, or are there tweaks that you'd like to see made for the more permanent version before we have to go?
Well, I think that it does need to be even strengthened even more. However, I would like to address what was just said. That's a false claim that it is racially biased, and there's a lot of independent evidence that shows that it is not. So I have to vehemently disagree with the previous speaker, but basically, we would like to make it permanent because it has been shown to be so effective. And on top of it, to the parents' concern who wrote into you, that's one of the problems that I would like to address in the legislation, in that families need to be educated as to the options that are out there for them if they have a loved one, especially an adult child, for example, who has severe mental illness.
So just to be clear, State Senator, I'm sorry to cut you short. I know we're racing the clock. You think that Kendra's law in its current form is ready to be made permanent?
Well, I've passed legislation repeatedly in the Senate to make it permanent, but also to make updates to it to make it even stronger, to fill in some of the grit gaps, because one of the issues with Kendra's law is that it's underutilized. We want it to be utilized more, and we think that there are changes that actually make it stronger, make it more user-friendly, and make it more effective. And so it's been shown to be a tremendous tool and, has a tremendous impact on people's lives in a very positive way.
Gotcha.
That's why it should be permanent. But I also would like to make some changes to it and make it even stronger.
That is New York Republican State Senator Catherine Young. Senator Young, thanks very much for talking to us.
Thank you.
Bill Keller, the editor-in-chief of the Marshall Project. Thank you, Bill.
Thank you.
Duke University psychiatry professor Marvin Swartz. Thank you, doctor.
Thank you.
And Beth Harula, senior staff attorney at the New York Civil Liberties Union. Beth, thanks very much.
Thank you.
This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Joshua Johnson. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you tomorrow for the Friday News Roundup. This is 1A.